Today at Reader's Corner, Todd Lending, author of the new novel, The Umbrella Maker's Son. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, Todd Lending joins us to talk about his debut novel, The Umbrella Maker's Son. Set in World War II Poland, the book follows 17-year-old Reuven, a young man born to a working-class Jewish family who suddenly finds himself fighting to save his life and to locate the young woman, Zelda, who holds his heart. Todd Lending is an Academy Award-nominated and Emmy-winning producer, director, writer, and cinematographer. He is the president and founder of Nomadic Pictures, a documentary film production based in Chicago. A beautiful companion piece to his debut novel is Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survival Band. It is a film about two Holocaust survivors who start up a band to celebrate life and remember traditions and memories the Nazis could not kill. Todd Lending, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
The inspiration for Reuven, the protagonist in your novel, and his flight to freedom is your great-grandfather. Why don't we just begin by telling our listeners who was your great-grandfather, both in Europe and then in America?
Sure. And let me clarify. I would say my great-grandfather was one of the influences for Reuven.
Yes.
Reuven was a combination of several influences.
Right. Actually. And we're going to talk about some of those other ones because of your documentary, which is Saul and Ruby's Holocaust
Survivor Band.
Survivor Band.
Holocaust,
yeah.
Survivor Band, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, my great-grandfather, we actually don't know a lot about him, unfortunately. I wish I knew a lot more. His name was Raphael Lending. He was an umbrella maker in Warsaw at the turn of the 20th century, so late 1800s, very early 1900s. And well, at that time, Warsaw was actually in Russia. It had not become Poland yet. But in that area in Eastern Europe, there was virulent anti-Semitism. There were pogroms. It was a very difficult time for the Jews there. And my great-grandfather was married, had 10 children. And he one day, as the story goes, what we do know is he was coming home from work and he encountered a Polish policeman beating up a Jew. And he got involved in the altercation. He had embedded in the stem of his umbrella a dagger. And he had that for protection because of the times. And he got involved in the fight and he ended up stabbing the policeman. And that was the event that actually catalyzed their move away out of Warsaw. They traveled over to Hamburg, Germany. They got on the ship, the SS St. Paul, and crossed the ocean and made it to Ellis Island on Christmas Day, 1909. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what we know. My grandfather, who was his son, Edward Lending, was silent about his experience. He was 14 years old when he came here. So he definitely knew and saw and remembered what he had been through, but he would not talk about it. And the other nine children also were that we assumed they were really traumatized by what they had been through, and it just wasn't something they talked about. So that's pretty much what I know about him. So the title of the book came from what he did, that he was this umbrella maker. That's where the concept came from. And of course, Reuven's father has this custom made umbrella shop where they create some of the finest umbrellas in Poland with these elaborately hand-carved umbrella handles that are made to order for people. And Reuven is planning on going in the same business. So that's kind of the extent. And then that story that I just told is actually also a turning point in the first part of the book.
Right. Well, you know, you talk about how much your family doesn't know, and the fact that your grandfather wasn't talking about this, even though he was 14 and obviously had some memories. But of course, they liked to bury those memories. But this is a moment when I want to appeal to our listeners who are younger than me anyway. My grandmother left Poland at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century as well. She was not Jewish, so she didn't leave for reasons having to do with the Nazis. It was way before that, like your great grandfather. But she did come to America out of poverty. I mean, basically, there was no way to live and work where she was in Eastern Poland. And I didn't ask any questions over my youth and into my adulthood, for that matter. And now I'm asking all kinds of questions, and they're all gone. I can get no answers. And it's a plea with younger folks, and I'm not talking about kids. I mean adults who never thought to sit down with their families and ask questions. How did this happen, and how did that happen? And I only wish I could have done that. But anyway, moving on with your book.
I think that's a great point. Yeah.
I just brought that out
for your listeners. That's important.
So when it comes to your book, it's not just your book that I so much enjoyed and highly recommend to our listeners. It's also the documentary you did, and it's called Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band. And I must point out to our listeners that if you hear us refer to Saul and Ruby as he and him, it's because Ruby, even though it's usually used as a woman's name, in this case, it's a man. And I want to let you tell the story, first of all, of Saul and Ruby and what they decided to do, and then how you got involved. It's an amazing documentary. I highly recommend it. I think I watched it on Amazon Prime yesterday afternoon. I don't know where else you can get it. You may know that, Todd.
Amazon Prime is the pardon the pun, but the prime source for streaming it. So that was a film that I made before I wrote this novel. That was the last film, the last documentary I had made, period, in my 38 years of making documentaries. That's just so your listeners know that that's my background. I spent 38 years making what are called longitudinal documentaries, which are documentaries where I follow people over years. In the case of Saul and Ruby, I followed them for 2.5 years from the day they decided to form this band. And I was immediately taken by their story. I had read about them in the New York Times, and there was a short piece on them, of a short, like a trailer piece. And I thought, oh, you know, some other filmmaker already is on this. And a friend of mine said, look, you don't know that, you know, you seem interested in these two men, so check it out. And I called, I got a hold of Saul, and it turned out this fellow from the New York Times was not doing a film about him, but there were now other production companies going after him. And so I was so entranced by these two men that I jumped on a plane the next day, flew down to Florida, met Saul. We made a deal and agreed to work together. And so, by the way, I had never made a Jewish-themed film in my entire career. I am of Jewish background, and I had always focused on stories of minorities, primarily, you know, social issue-driven stories that could be they're everything from addiction to incarceration to racism to poverty. Never had done a Jewish-themed story. So personally, this was really important for me, and it was a passion project. It was a project I funded out of my company. There was no time to raise funds. And so I followed them over this period, and we ended up going to, you know, their goal was to make it back to Poland, which is where they were both from, and play their music there. And they wanted to basically travel the world and tell their stories of survival and play music as a way, it's a way of healing for them. I finished that film. It was released in January of 2020. COVID was just kind of looming in the background at that point. The film did extremely well at its first festival. It won the Grand Jury Prize. It was the opening film for the festival. It went to the second festival, won the Audience Award. We were all excited. Samuel Goldwyn Films picked it up for distribution, and we thought we were just going gangbusters. And then COVID shut everything down in March. And so, like many filmmakers, like many people in all different types of fields, you know, it was shocking. It was sad. I felt terrible for Saul and Ruby. They could no longer travel with the film. And everything came to a stop. And at that point, I decided it was time for me to write. I had been wanting to write a novel for years, and I thought, you know what, this is the time. I don't want to be out filming right now in COVID. And so I pivoted to novel writing. And I started with a very different story. I started writing a story about a single dad, a contemporary story about a single dad raising a very tough daughter. I got 10 pages in. I wanted to go into the father's background and realized he's the son of survivors. I got engaged in the father, who was Reuven Berkovits, the main character of this novel.
Right.
And it was like a dam broke. I mean, the story just completely flowed out of me. And that's how the book came about.
Well, it's just a remarkable feat. There's no doubt about it. Are you going to stick with this? I hope you are
Oh,
thinking
yeah.
of, yeah, good.
Oh, yeah. I'm on
Yeah.
number two. I'm
Oh,
finishing
good.
the first draft on the next novel. So,
Oh, that's great to hear.
oh,
Great to
yeah.
hear. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Todd Lending, author of the new novel, The Umbrella Maker's Son. So in the documentary, you visited Warsaw and Krakow, which happens to be the two of the important locations in your novel. But in real life, these were very different places. Well, maybe I shouldn't say very different, but the Warsaw Ghetto, I heard about that. The Warsaw Ghetto is more in history than, at least for me, than the Krakow Ghetto. And I guess it was a bit smaller, just given the size of the two cities. But I noticed that when you went back with Saul and Ruby to find their homelands and to find their literal places of birth and growing up as kids, it was a lot easier in Krakow than it was in Warsaw. And I guess that's just because Warsaw was blown to bits, and Krakow is still an old city.
That's exactly correct. And Warsaw, there were two things that happened when we were there. I mean, number one, so both men wanted to really go back to the very homes, that they grew up in. And in the case of Ruby, yeah, Ruby grew up in Warsaw and wrote Warsaw, as you said, had been leveled. And so what Warsaw is now is all post-war construction. And so Ruby was also young. He was 10 years old when the war started on September 1st, 1939, and he was with his family, and they knew it was time to escape after as the Germans occupied their city, and so they headed east towards Russian border. They wanted to cross the border, and Ruby got separated from his parents and ended up on a farm. For 4 years, he was hidden in a barn. And he has barely a memory of what happened. So again, we're dealing with issues of trauma. He may have been, I mean, I questioned him ad nauseum about, what did you eat? What did you do during the day? Where did you go at night? How did you survive the winters? How did you stay warm? It's just, he
Yeah.
really couldn't answer these questions. Now, in the case of Saul, Krakow was preserved because the Germans decided to use Krakow as the location for their central government. So that they moved in there and took over a lot of the housing, the buildings, the offices, because that's where they were controlling the east from literally from Krakow. And so Saul was able to go back, and Saul's memory is phenomenal, as you saw in the film. I mean, and so he was able to walk the streets and tell you everything that happened, and you could smell the smells. And we went inside of his building, and he wept. He wasn't able to go up the stairs, but I got a sense of really the cobblestone streets are the same, the buildings are the same. He was pointing out where the fishmonger was, where the baker was. This is where he kicked the soccer ball and broke out a guy's window. This is where he went to school. And so for me, unbeknownst to me, all this information he was giving me was going into my memory, and that became absolutely essential research for writing the novel.
Yes, well, as I listen to it, I'm thinking through the novel where Reuven decides to take off eastward as well, mm-hmm. trying to escape the Nazis, convinces his parents that this is something they must do, even though they don't want to leave. And back to Ruby, or this is Saul, I guess. As far as Saul is concerned, in Krakow, is he in Krakow?
Yes, yeah. Saul's in Krakow.
So Saul actually takes you to the spot on the square where the Nazis shot and killed his grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to your point about memory, it can't get any more horrible than that, I guess would be the best way to say that.
More horrible and more real, and yeah. which again fed into, I think, the realistic writing and scenes that, although I did not use that scene in the book, but just again, being with him, imagining that. And what I did use, which is important to point out, is the pharmacy that he was inside,
yes.
watching his grandma get shot. That pharmacy is called the Pod Orem Pharmacy, which means under the eagle. And it was run by a man who is an absolute hero, a Polish Catholic, by the name of Tadeusz Pankiewicz. And his father founded that pharmacy. Tadeusz took it over. And he is an absolute hero in real life. I mean, this guy was the only pharmacy in the Krakow ghetto. He convinced when the Germans created the ghetto, they made sure that anyone who was not Jewish was not allowed inside. But he convinced the Germans to allow him to stay to provide, you know, his services to the Jews there. Somehow he convinced them. And he stayed inside of his pharmacy. He lived inside the pharmacy for the entire 3 years. He didn't leave it because he was afraid the minute he stepped outside the ghetto, they wouldn't allow him back in. So his assistants would go in and out. And I'm telling you about this man because he is a character in the novel. And mm-hmm. his assistants go in and out, and they bring in supplies, and they also bring in things like news, like newspapers and magazines, which are not allowed inside the ghetto. They smuggled them in so that the Jews could get some sense of what the hell was going on in the outside world and during the war. The Germans were trying to completely isolate them so they wouldn't know anything. He provided escape routes. He had a vault beneath his pharmacy where he stored Torahs and other sacred religious items. So he was an amazing man. And so in the book, when people read the book, the man, Mr. Malinowski, is modeled after Tadeusz Pankiewicz.
Well, it's so well done. And by the way, I think there's a book out about this gentleman, The Krakow Ghetto Pharmacy. Isn't that correct?
That's his memoir. Yes. Yeah, and that was a key source, another key source for me for research, was his memoir.
So there was a forced labor camp nearby. Plaszow, is that how you say it?
Plaszow.
Plaszow.
Yeah.
Plaszow. Tell us about Plaszow and what role that plays in your novel. But of course, that is yanked from real life.
Yes. So Plaszow, plays an important role. It's I learned about Plaszow through Saul. Saul in the film had worked in Plaszow. It was a labor camp. So while it wasn't a death camp like Auschwitz, unfortunately, hundreds, thousands of people did die there. From the conditions, from the typhoid, from starvation, from, you know, working. They had three places of work. There were two armament factories that people were forced to work in, and there was a stone quarry. And so the camp was run by an absolute sadist by the name of Amon Goeth. And people who've seen Schindler's List will remember this character, Amon Goeth. It's played by Ralph Fiennes. He was a horrible man. He would shoot people from his balcony. He would get on a white stallion and ride through camp and shoot people from his stallion. Saul had been whipped and abused by him. So in the novel, Reuven ends up working at Plaschow. And a lot of the things that he experiences and goes through are adapted from some of the things that Saul told me, but also from, there's another key source of research that I used, which is, again, a firsthand account. It's called The Krakow Diary by Julius mm-hmm. Feldman. And Julius Feldman was 17 years old when the war started. And he wrote this diary, and he died. He ended up dying in Plaschow. They found the diary hidden in one of the walls of the barrack. But his account, it's short, it's 80 pages, but it's a firsthand account of just what life was like when the Germans occupied Krakow and how his family began losing the rights one step at a time, from the right to own a radio, to the right to own a car, to the right to own a home or an apartment, the right to own a business. It was one step at a time, chafing away. It didn't just happen all at once. And that really is like the main theme of the book, is about the layers of loss and how that impacts different people in his family.
Well, I remember specifically where Jewish families would be moved out of their homes, sent to very inferior places to live, and then Poles, the Germans would give these homes to non-Jewish Poles,
yes,
who would then take over. And I mean, if that isn't an example of what these people were going through in these years. Today, I'm speaking with Todd Lending, author of the novel, The Umbrella Maker's Son. The book is a coming-of-age tale following a 17-year-old Polish Jew as he fights for his life and experiences his first love, set during World War II Poland. You know, your novel is also a love story, Todd. It's Reuven trying to find Zelda, his girlfriend. And it's one of millions that really never have been told, because it ended for too many people. But it does remind us of how the Nazis were not able to exterminate either their faith or principles, traditions, love of family and friends. I think that's what's special about your novel, is that you come away with hope, as Reuven had through his entire ordeal.
Mm. I'm so glad to hear that, because I know it's a tough read. It goes deep into the losses and the sufferings, but I absolutely, the other two themes that I wove in there is what you just said, love and resilience. And love is the antidote for Reuven, for a lot of the loss he goes through, and love is also what fuels his resilience. And I was very much hoping, I wanted to give people some hope, given the dark realities of that situation. But I also felt beholden to telling the truth of really how bad it was. So as a writer, you know, you are kind of walking a tightrope between wanting to get across how horrific that time period was for the Jewish people, while at the same time giving your reader some sense of hope. And I'm glad that you felt that. Mm-hmm. And I also want to say, I hope that people, one of the questions I get asked, or I ask myself when I give these presentations at bookstores or, you know, in front of other audiences, is what is the role of Holocaust stories post October 7th? And it's a question I ask, because I started writing this book before the events of October 7th. And I felt, you know, that Holocaust stories, I always thought of them as very focused on Jewish history and the story of our Jewish ancestors. Post October 7th, I began to focus a little bit more on these stories being lessons in that apply to everyone, that apply to everyone, not just Jews, but also they apply to Palestinians, they apply to Uyghurs, they apply, you know, to black, the story of black slavery, this all the stories, all the historical sufferings around where people have been dehumanized by another group of people, another nation. I hope that people will understand and see this story in that context, that this does not, you know, it's a story of of people who are being dehumanized. And I think it applies to a lot of what's happening around the world today.
Well, I thought of Ukraine when I read your
and
novel.
Ukraine, exactly.
I mean, it's obviously a neighbor of Poland, but today it faces some of the same challenges that Germany and Europe faced in the 1930s as this buildup of Nazism was spreading across Germany first and then the rest of Eastern Europe. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you also must have had some thoughts on how this applies to the current malaise we happen to be in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're living in, you write a book like this and you feel a lot of the parallels that are unfolding around the world today in regards to, you know, autocratic rulers and oppression of other people. Yeah, absolutely. What's happening in Ukraine? We haven't seen this since World War II. It's something we have to do something about it. And it's very hard to figure out as this unfolds what exactly we need to do. And I'm trying to be careful here and not getting too political. I don't want to turn off any right. viewers here. This is not a political forum, but I want to just say generally, you know, without naming names or taking any sides here, you know, we must listen to each other. You know, whatever side you're on the political spectrum, we cannot dehumanize the other side. It's easy for the left and for the right, especially extreme left, extreme right, to do that to each other. And we really need to avoid that. It will only lead to disaster the minute we start dehumanizing others.
Yeah, that's well put. Back to your documentary for a moment.
Sure.
Are Ruby and Saul still with us?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So Saul is turning 100. April 29th is his birthday.
Oh, wow.
And the man is insane. I mean, he's still going. He just did a gig. He did several gigs in L.A. You know, he lives in Florida. He flew to L.A. He did a few gigs there, banging on the drums, playing klezmer music. He's still sharp as a tack. I mean, the man has some amazing genes, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. And Ruby, so they're no longer actually in touch. Like so many bands, they had a split. Egos got in the way. But Ruby is still playing. He's also still has his marbles. He's about 4 years younger than Saul. So he's 96. I think he's turning 97 this year. He's still doing well. And when you look at what these two men had been through, it's just mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling what they've survived and how they've thrived. And you talk about resilience. I mean, where does that come from? You know, it's amazing.
You mentioned that scene when Saul finally gets the opportunity to see where he lived. And he goes rushing in, all excited about finding it, and then just instantly, he's overwhelmed by the very thought of losing. I think at one point he says, "There were 30 of us in our family. I am now alone."
Yeah,
and he walks out in tears, unable to climb the stairs to see where he grew up.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, it was hard. I mean, honestly, it was hard to keep the camera on my shoulder at that point. I felt myself, I'm gonna break
Yeah.
down in tears here. It was so emotional. It just came on him. It just flooded him, and it just overwhelmed him. And it was unexpected. I mean, he was all excited. He went in there with all this excitement. Hey, this is
Yeah.
where we're at. And then boom, he got smacked with the reality of his losses. And
Yeah.
it's hard for a lot of us to imagine what is it like to lose everybody. Everybody in your family, uncles, aunts, your parents, your sister. I mean, it's difficult to imagine that. But there are people that go through it here with you know, the disasters that have hit some of these communities, and people losing everything they had, their homes, losing loved ones. I mean, it continues to happen for various reasons around the world.
And your book is certainly an inspiration to folks who suffered loss, because it does leave a message that there is some, in fact, something to live for. There's something to remember, and we cannot forget, as every Holocaust survivor has reminded us.
Correct. Correct. We
Well, I so much have enjoyed this conversation, Todd. And once again, I
can.
do want to remind our listeners that the name of the book is The Umbrella Maker's Son by Todd Lending. The name of the documentary is Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band. And if you read the book and then watch the documentary, you will see how intertwined they are, thanks to the magic of Todd here. Todd, can you tell us anything about your next book? I know authors like to be careful about this. Are you going to stay? Are you going to stay in Europe, or you're moving someplace else?
I'm moving. I am. I'm moving. So I'm moving to Chicago in this book.
Oh,
It
great.
takes place in Chicago, 1982, and I'll be very vague about it.
Yeah.
But it is a crime story and also a love story at the same time. And it does have the long shadow of the Holocaust hanging over it. The crime that occurs has a connection, a link to what occurred during the Holocaust. So I'll say
Oh,
that
that sounds interesting. So when can we expect that to be on the shelves?
So I'm finishing up the first draft. I would hope it could be on the shelves maybe by late next year is what I would hope. But you never know. You get it to the publisher, it all depends. First of all, you have to pray to God that the publisher will want it.
Right.
The competition is unbelievable.
The basics here.
Oh my God, let's start with that. So you
Yeah.
pray that the publisher will take it, and if they do, it depends on, timing is like, it depends on what they have lined up, where they think the theme of that book would best fit, the best release time for it. So who knows? But I would hope that I get it into them, within like another 6 months, and then hopefully get it published sometime next year, late next year.
Great, great. Well,
Yeah.
once again, we've been talking to Todd Lending. The book is The Umbrella Maker's Son, a novel of World War II. And the documentary, once again, is Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band. Todd, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, thanks so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.